everyone. This is JJ Osland, venture investor and co-host of How I Sold This, a podcast where we unpack stories of venture acquisitions to learn from founders and M&A teams that have built, sold, or purchased startups. In this episode, we'll hear from Kareem Attia, who co-founded a startup called Paribus that helps consumers save on their everyday purchases. After just 2 years, he sold Paribus to Capital One for an undisclosed amount, but one that produced a great result for his team and for the investors. Also, a special shout out to Tony Blank over at Twilio for introducing me to Kareem. Now, let's get started with today's episode. Kareem, thank you for joining the How I Sold This podcast. Would love if you could share a little bit about your background and the formation story for how you built Paribus.
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on the podcast, JJ. Going back to Paribus in the early days there. So at that time, I had been in New York City for about 2 years. My co-founder, Eric, had been in New York, same for about a year and a half. We were both working very hard at our jobs. I was traveling all the time. He was working very late hours in banking. And we just got to catch up here and there on weekends. And one of the things that we realized is, well, we were doing a lot of online shopping. Everything was just getting delivered. We had no time to go to the stores and buy things. And we realized that the items we were buying over time, like, were never the same price. So we started looking into the policies of stores, starting with Amazon, and realized not only that prices tend to drop over time, but that Amazon was starting to change their prices at an alarming rate. And I think at the time, that number we estimated to be around 150,000 price changes a day. A year later, it was closer to like 150 million. So that just gives you a sense of like how often these prices are changing. And that was right around the time where like everyone was talking about data science. Large companies were putting together like their data and data science teams. Amazon certainly had a team there in charge of making sure that they were changing the price in such a way that they were able to just maximize profits. And we're like, okay, we got an opportunity here.
Great. So you start the company, it's around 2014, and then you go through Y Combinator. What was that experience? How did that shape the company in the early days?
Yeah, so the full story on that is we actually applied to Y Combinator twice. The first time we were still working on Paribus as a part-time project. So we still hadn't left our full-time jobs. And I'm guessing the Y Combinator kind of saw through that. It's like these people are not committed, or maybe I'm overanalyzing here. But the bottom line is we didn't get in the first time. But that only motivated us more. So at that point we quit our jobs, which was a little harder for me given the visa situation. But I figured something out, and the next 6 months went at it 100%. And by the second time the YC application came around, we not only had grown to about 1,000 or so users, but we also had gotten in to present at TechCrunch Disrupt, which in a way also helped us as a launch platform. And I could talk a little bit through the details of how YC went, but the summary there is that it was a life-changing, amazing experience that I recommend to everyone, specifically first-time founders, but really anyone can benefit from it.
And you raised a seed round coming out of YC. You raised from some pretty notable Bay Area investors, General Catalyst, Greylock, Foundation Capital. What were you pitching these investors at that stage coming out of Y Combinator? What was the vision for the company? Did you have any conversations about the exit potential and what those options could look like for the business?
So we didn't have too many discussions about the exit potential, but we certainly had a lot of questions around what this would become. At the time, I think the questions that investors kept asking was like, okay, great, you seem to have built a great feature, but how does that become a large scale product? Our answer was like, look, consumers are trusting us with access to their receipts and their purchasing information. We're only scratching the surface by getting them refund. There's a trove of information in those receipts that we can use to help consumers save. And we want to build additional products that use that information and help users make better decisions and get the money they're owed, right? And some of the like the natural next steps that we started working on were around helping users save for hotel reservations, flights. We thought about auto rental. We were going to do things around insurance at some point, but that didn't really make sense. But the point was like the starting point was those receipts and that purchase data. And then what we had that a lot of companies that people thought of as competitors at the time didn't have was kind of the agency to take action on behalf of users. That's something that is quite powerful. And we wanted to become that, like the trusted agent of consumers.
Right. And being in that position, you know, there's a lot of value in having both that trust, that access to that type of data. One thing I think is really interesting about the company, you know, as opposed to a lot of companies you see today, is just the how quickly you decided to sell after raising the seed round. I do want to dig into how you came to that decision. But first, I would like to touch on what that growth did look like and what was happening behind the scenes between the point when you did raise that seed round and then when you eventually did sell the company to Capital One.
So it was summer. So we went through YC summer 15. We raised that seed round end of summer 15. Distribution was the big focus. It's like, okay, how do we grow this company? Mark, who was the first external hire we made, and Nick Greenfield, who came from Wash.io at the time, focused on that, on just helping us grow and getting us more users. And I mean, we kept a 10% a week pace of growth from the YC days. I think by January we were already at 100,000 users. 6 months later, we probably had quintupled again. So we were getting a lot of fast growth.
Yeah. What factor was contributing the most to that rapid growth, 10% week over week?
I mean, if I had to pick one, I'd say I think we made the right hires. And we could get through the details of that earlier. But a lot of like those early members of Paribus who joined the team are now running like tens of millions, in some cases $100 million businesses. And like, look, my brother Mark went on and starting his company. Nick, who was our chief operating officer, now runs Candid, the teeth aligner company. So he started that, and like they're a $500 million plus company. And Karen, who was my VP of engineering and then replaced me at the CTO as the CTO at Capital One, runs a company, like a beauty company called Everybody. So like totally different spaces, but everyone has like done quite well. And like I invested in their companies, they invested in our new company. And like we refer people to each other, like we work with some of the same investors. So it's been pretty great.
Yeah, it's like the PayPal mafia, but you've got the Paribus mafia, which is cool to see, you know, the ripple effects.
We're trying.
I want to bring up a quote from Daniel Gross, who is one of our past guests. And what he said he tells founders is that entertaining the idea of an acquisition can be a toxic mind virus. I'm interested in your thoughts on this, and how much were you thinking about the potential exit for the company while you were scaling during this time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I partly agree with what he's saying. At the same time, I think not being aware of how potential acquirers think can put you at a disadvantage. But we did not, like, I wouldn't say that we spent any time dreaming or thinking about like, hey, like these people are going to reach out and try to buy us, or like we should go and reach out to these folks and see if they were interested. So we certainly did not waste any time on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. So during that time, you know, you weren't actively reaching out to potential acquirers. However, did you have any inbound from companies, you know, aside from Capital One, that were, you know, approaching you with this conversation?
We were speaking with some of them, but it was with the goal of doing a partnership in mind. I mean, at the end of the day, banks and credit card companies were very interesting to us because they had all the data about what people were buying and when.
So you were already talking about potential partnerships. How did that conversation navigate into M&A talks?
Yeah, that was interesting. So we were talking potential partnerships, but at the same time, we were starting to think about, the way forward. And typically for, I mean, after raising a seed, the next step is a Series A. So we were in conversations and we're thinking about raising a Series A and had term sheets. In some ways, like we were lucky enough to have both options. And that's what we were comparing. It's like the math of raising the Series A and going at it for another couple of years, couple of months, growing the team, going through those challenges, or selling and what it meant from an economic perspective, but also like how it would impact our life and our employees' lives, and how we would shape the next 2 years, and how we would just grow as founders and technologists. I'd say it evolved quite naturally. I mean, Capital One was really interested in a partnership. We started talking about it. We started talking numbers and technology and what we had built, and we really liked their team and they really liked our team. And I think at some point they made it clear that they wanted something more than just a partnership. And we were very honest and open at that time that like we were in the process of raising a Series A. So if they were actually serious, we would have to move very fast. And we had spoken to a couple advisors and friends at that time and understood that most acquisition talks fail and don't mean anything. They're also very slow and very risky. So, like, frankly, I just wasn't sure it was going to happen until maybe the day we signed.
Yeah. So, you know, like you mentioned, engaging in these types of conversations can take a lot of time. It can take a lot of focus away from the things that are important to grow the business. And that's definitely something you're weighing, especially at the seed stage when the team's still smaller and when there's still a lot of room for growth. So how did you decide to continue down that path? Was there consensus amongst the investors in the company and with you and your co-founder? Or was there more back and forth about making that decision?
I mean, it's a good question. It's kind of hard to answer it succinctly. So we had a term sheet on the table, and at some point we had an offer from Capital One. The offer was life-changing, and it also meant that we at that time we also had full control, and it felt that it might be the last time that we fully controlled our own destiny as well. Cause like, as you're aware, as you raise larger and larger rounds, those decisions come with a lot of asterisks, with veto rights and rights of first refusal and all sorts of strings that come attached to fundraising rounds. And at that time we kind of like had full control over our own decisions. So we spoke to a couple advisors, and I'd be lying if I didn't say if some of these conversations didn't have a very strong impact on me, but like some very prominent founders told us, or like two of them gave us like a very similar advice, which was like, hey, as a venture investor, I would tell you to keep going, but on a personal level, like you should sell. So there was a lot of these conversations that were going on, and it was kind of hard to discount that. So that was one side of it. The other one, which was that pushed us over the edge, and that had a big impact on both me and Eric, which is we talked to a lot of other folks who had gone through acquisitions, some that we knew well, some we didn't. And we realized that in most cases, acquisitions end up being very bad for employees for many reasons. I mean, liquidation prefs is one of them, but I mean, sometimes it's just like their retention packages are bad. Like there's just no reward for the early employee who came and worked twice as hard, got paid half as much, and didn't benefit from that like positive outcome. In our case, we were at that time, we had been very generous on equity. And I think, also in our negotiations with Capital One, made sure that the outcomes would be amazing for every single member of the team. And it really felt like a good decision, not just for us, but for everyone else. And I don't know that we could have said the same thing if we had raised another two rounds and then sold much later.
Yeah, that's helpful context. You mentioned, you know, the impact for you personally. You know, you you weighed those options and you felt like, you know, the timing was good. How about for your existing investors? Was there any pushback around, no, let's continue to grow this? Or did you have alignment there?
Yeah, it was actually interesting. So at the time, like all our discussions with Capital One had to be completely confidential. So, and we did not have an outside board member at the time. So it just meant that we had full control and flexibility over our decisions. So we did not receive pushback from our investors when we discussed our decision with them. And at the same time, I think that's pretty common. It's like no investor wants to be the one telling you to keep going when you've already made the different decision. I feel like no one benefits from this. I'd be surprised if any of those investors were not happy with the outcome, because even though, yeah, sure, it probably didn't return their fund and that's what they're solving for most of the time, like it was a very fast exit. For a lot of these investors, I mean, some of them had spent a couple years at venture funds and that was their first meaningful exit. So an exit is a real thing. So it helps, and it helps that it was quick. And I think we've built amazing relationships with them. Some of them we're working with again on this new company. I like to think it was a great outcome for everyone.
Right. And why do you think it is that, you know, these quick exits, I mean, it's obvious from the investor point of view, you know, that they want to invest in companies that could return the fund. But why do you think it is pretty uncommon for there to be quick exits like this today? Do you think the motivations, I guess, you know, are just very different for the types of founders that are able to raise capital?
I don't think that's necessarily yet. I mean, I think most quick early exits that either happen or are proposed are usually on terms that are terrible for the team, right? It's they're usually like acqui-hire type exits, and no founder who's quit a high-paying job to go to a startup is just going to want to be acquired for a great salary. And it's hard to catch the eye of an interesting potential acquirer on good terms unless you're growing very fast. And usually if you're growing very fast, you have all the options in the world to raise more and stay fully independent. You don't really need to think about it. And I feel like in some way also it's gotten more common to at some later rounds provide liquidity options for founders and early employees so that they don't feel the need to entertain the idea of an exit when sometimes they have like so much of their life and frankly like net worth tied to the company.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love that perspective. And if we transition to the perspective of Capital One, what was it that they were looking for at this time? And you know, how did this fit into their strategy, and why was this a good fit for them?
Yeah, we were actually very aligned. I think like we had other partners we were talking to, but it was clear that Capital One was most aligned and on our vision and our way of things, seeing things. And for them, it was honestly about just making customers happy. And when you truly think about it, and you think about like the times you hear from your bank, no matter which bank, it's usually to tell you that there was a fraudulent transaction, or you're over your limit, or your password was hacked, or it's usually bad news. It's like every time you hear from your bank, it's bad news. And for them, just being not only seen as the bearer of bad news, but like the company that's behind helping you get the money you're owed, helping you save, helping you spend smarter, really fit within their ethos and their mission, which is to change banking for good. So that was certainly part of it. Another part of it that was interesting personally to me as the CTO is that out of all the banks, they were probably the most advanced on the technology side of things. They had real high-performing engineering teams working on interesting products. Now, granted, it's still very hard to build things within a banking-regulated environment, but it was interesting to see the importance that they gave to just in engineering and technology and building good products for consumers. So there was a lot of that as well.
Love that. So let's
Let's do a walkthrough really quick of just what those conversations look like in the negotiations. You know, I know you can't share, you know, the end purchase price and all of those terms, but what were the most important things for you? You'd mentioned where the employees would end up. What in those negotiations were the things that, you know, were most important to you? And then what did you feel was most important to them as a business?
So yeah, you're absolutely right. Number one for us was the team and the people and where they ended up and whether they would be happy. So we put in the right packages in place. We talked about the right role for the right people and got buy-in from Capital One to grow teams that needed to be grown or add budget where we felt like budget needed to be added. So that was like a big one. The other one is we wanted to make sure that we were still able to move as fast as we could. Having that ability to deploy code and ship product as fast as we were was extremely important to us. And that one, we had the question marks on. And I wouldn't say that it was all great, but like for a while within Capital One, we still were able to ship product and iterate very fast. But then at some point, like the integration challenges came along there was a whole other story, but look, impact was the big one. I mean, that hasn't changed. We built Paribus because we wanted to have a big impact, help as many customers as we could, and we did that within Capital One. We had a lot of support from the senior executives there who were extremely helpful. I mean, we had a budget that was in many ways orders of magnitude larger than the money we had raised at Paribus. So it was interesting to see what we could do at scale.
When looking at the price, I imagine having a term sheet in hand was pretty good leverage as you were having these negotiations. How did that impact the final outcome for you guys?
No, absolutely. Having that term sheet gave us a lot of leverage. I mean, and it's just real. I mean, after you raise a Series A, the numbers would have to look very different, and the decision makers would also probably be different. So we not only had to make sure that the right price was hit, but also that we moved very fast, because I mean we were also like running out of cash, right? It's like we can't do a 1-year process and not raise.
Great. And during this process of building the company, and especially during the process of making this decision to sell the company, are there any specific mentors that you remember that gave you advice that were crucial in that time period?
Yeah, absolutely. And I can mention some names, but like Justin Kahn was instrumental during that period. Jeff Wu, who was a good friend of ours who had sold his company to, I believe, Groupon the year prior, was also extremely instrumental. Zachary Frankel, it's a combination of folks either who had sold their companies before or, really all of them had sold at least one company before or had been involved in the sale of a company. So all very helpful.
Right. So after the fact, you know, as your team joined the Capital One team, you know, you mentioned there are already a lot of new opportunities for them in a larger business with more budgets and resources. What were some of the challenges, or are there any challenges that you didn't anticipate that, you know, arose when you're in that process of transition?
Yeah, absolutely. On my side of the world, having been focused and involved in like the technology and engineering side of things, I'd say integrating with a large company is extremely challenging, especially if you're trying to move fast. And that was something that took a long time to achieve and to try to do properly. But I'd say like you have to make compromises. Hopefully both parties negotiating that integration are reasonable and have their incentives aligned. And especially when you're talking about doing it through the confines of a heavily regulated bank, that was tough. I mean, separately, I would say that we had a lot of buy-in to do things fast and to push product from the C-suite and the executives there. But the reality on the ground is that it's like a decision and support from the decision makers in a large company is not always enough, because there's so many different groups and parties that you have to work with. So just consensus building and involving the right people at the right time just means that your way of shipping product is just a lot slower in some cases.
So after staying on with Capital One for a couple of years during that integration process and transition, you eventually decided to leave and start a new company called Ramp. What can you share about that? Was this a decision you knew that you would make eventually, or did you just see an opportunity and decide that you had to build a new company?
Yeah, I'd say I knew I'd be working on something new anyway at some point. I just didn't know when it was. After 2.5 years at Capital One, it felt like it was the right time. So yeah, so we're building this corporate card that's going to help companies keep their burn low. If you look at what's available in the market today, most cards will tap rewards and points, and we think that that's inherently misaligned with their customers and when these customers are businesses with those businesses. I mean, businesses are trying to grow, to stay alive, to be successful, and incentivizing them to spend more is not always the right thing. So we're coming up with some interesting and creative ways to help companies save money, keep their burn low, and we'll have a product out in the market by the end of the year, hopefully.
That's really exciting. And looking back at your time with Paribus, are there any big lessons that you take away that have changed your approach to building this company?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, as I mentioned, like really early on, I mean, one of the things that we were really excited to do as part of Capital One, and when we're thinking about partnering with banks, is really trying to build intelligence on top of a credit card transaction. It's extremely hard to do as part of a large company, but like as a small, nimble startup that has completely built our credit card tech stack from the ground up, like we're able to essentially do things to make transactions smarter. We're able to run analysis, trigger events at the time of the transaction, which is something that was just very challenging as part of a big bank. So we want to help people save. We want to make transactions smarter. I feel like in some ways, like the only innovation that I can think of that has happened with credit card recently is new ways of giving you points and making it seem like those points are worth more. Or turning your card off and on, but they're really like not much has happened.
Very cool. So yeah, that the experience really gave you a lot of knowledge and understanding of, you know, from a technical perspective, as well as what are the industry problems that you can solve. Any parting words that you have for founders listening to this podcast that are perhaps building their company right now, perhaps they are weighing options that they have to either sell the company or continue to raise? Any high level piece of advice that you give founders around that?
I'd say rely on good mentors. Like mentors can really be very, very helpful. I mean, I was lucky to have some really great ones. Whether it's through an accelerator program, or whether like when you're picking your investors, really think about that. Like mentors can help you, and generally when you are picking mentors, I would say like take advice from people who've been there before and done it before, and ignore all the advice from the people who haven't done it before and haven't been there, because you'll find that a lot of people love to give advice, and at the very least discount the advice that is given by people who have not solved a very similar problem to the one you've tried to solve yourself.
Well, thanks, Kareem. This was a really good talk. I think a lot of good takeaways for founders to learn from your experience. And we're really excited to see what you do with your new venture.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you, JJ.
As always, thank you for listening to this episode of How I Sold This. You can find more information about the podcast, as well as share your feedback and ideas with us at howisoldthis.co.